retaliatory strikes against the UAE going on. The Yemeni army hits Abu Dhabi and Dubai with ballistic missiles and drones. Tehran says it's awaiting Washington's political decision on the revival of the JCPOA. It once again calls for the verifiable removal of U.S. sanctions. Russia hitting back at Britain's threat of sanctions over the situation in Ukraine, saying it will respond if its businesses are attacked. This is World News, a live broadcast from Tehran with me, your host, Behrouz Najafi. Welcome. Starting with Yemen, the armed forces there are saying they have hit significant targets deep inside the UAE in a fresh retaliatory strike. The army spokesman Yahya Sari says that several Zulfikar missiles hit sensitive facilities in the capital Abu Dhabi, adding that several targets in Dubai were hit with unmanned aircraft. The general says the objectives of the operations have been met. He warned that the UAE will be under continued strikes as long as it launches operations against the people of Yemen. The army spokesman also warned Emirati citizens to stay away from sensitive facilities as they will be targeted in the upcoming attacks. The UAE is part of the Saudi-led coalition that has waged a war on Yemen since March 2015. Hundreds of thousands of people, mostly civilians, have been killed directly from war or indirectly from hunger and disease. Now, Abdul Latif al-Washali explains if and when the Yemeni forces would eventually stop their attacks on Emirati sites. Let's take a listen.
The UAE has been escalating its operations, whether on the ground or the aerial attacks against the Yemeni people. So the Yemeni army will absolutely respond to these attacks and attack Emirati facilities. This third version of Yemen storm operations will not be the last, even if the Emiratis announced withdrawing part of their forces in Yemen. The goal here is not only to make them or force them to withdraw some forces or stop the aerial attacks. Yemenis seek to expel all the Yemeni territories. They have to leave the Yemeni lands, and the Yemeni army will absolutely wage further attacks against whether Saudi Arabia or Emiratis. Yemeni people believe that the Saudi-led coalition, Saudi Arabia and the UAE are only proxies for the Israeli regime, so they will keep fighting these two regimes until the liberation of their land.
Now the latest from the Vienna talks on the revival of the Iran deal known as the JCPOA. Tehran says the negotiations will conclude once other signatories plus Washington make the right political decisions. Foreign Ministry spokesman says that a proper response to Iran's rightful demands will result in an agreement in the shortest possible time. Saeed Khatibzadeh says that this deal will be reliable if other sides do not make any requests beyond the scope and framework of the deal. He says that the sources of disagreement between the negotiating parties are clear, adding that there are yet unresolved issues regarding the removal of sanctions verifiably. He stressed that Washington needs to provide sufficient guarantees it won't violate international law again or target entities with transnational sanctions. The negotiating delegations will go back to Vienna to resume the talks in the coming days. Mohammad Randi is an advisor to the Iranian negotiating team in Vienna. He gives a recap of the basic elements of these negotiations and how they're proceeding.
They reached a point where those issues that need to be, that remain to be resolved, require major political decisions. And Tehran believes that the United States and its European allies have to make key decisions. If they want a nuclear deal, they're going to have to accept lifting sanctions. They can't expect Iran to go back to 2015 and implement the deal as it was back then, and then they remain with a framework of sanctions that they can use against ordinary people. That's just simply not acceptable. So they have to go back to their capitals. The Iranian delegation has come back to Tehran, and after a few days, they will be meeting again in Vienna to see where they can take things from there. Many issues have been resolved. As you know, a number of people from the American delegation were sent home, basically, arguably because the United States felt it had to be more flexible, and those two or three people were preventing that from happening. But still, that is not enough.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has called on producers and economic and industrial operators to work for economic growth and not to wait for the removal of U.S. sanctions. He made those comments in a meeting with local manufacturers and entrepreneurs. Yusuf Jalali was there and has the details.
Leading business owners, producers, and entrepreneurs were invited to a special place, Beit Rahbari. That's the official residence of Iran's leader. The meeting was aimed at allowing industrialists to share their concerns and highlight the major challenges they face in the production process with leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, listening and taking notes.
Your Highness, production is always associated with problems. If we want to produce, we need to brace for any possible problems. I dare say even the world's biggest entrepreneur, Mr. Bill Gates, could not manage a coffee shop under these difficult circumstances. But Iranian producers manage to run their businesses with all the foreign-imposed hardships.
Let's not sacrifice domestic production for imports. I proudly say that our biotech products have the capacity to be exported to other countries if the government lends its support.
At a time when the coronavirus pandemic led many countries to face shortage in medical supplies, Iran faced yet another problem, U.S. sanctions. But thanks to the efforts of our medical producers, we did not face any shortage in medical items during the pandemic.
We are fighting an economic war. We Iranian producers are the economic soldiers. So it's heartwarming when our leader lends his support for us. But it entails practical steps by authorities to make a change.
We got along with sanctions. We learned how to run our businesses despite the sanctions. The only thing we need to do is to modify our domestic regulations in favor of local producers.
Ayatollah Khamenei hailed the efforts of Iranian economic operators in keeping domestic production and the economy afloat amid the toughest sanctions imposed by the U.S. on Iran. He said thanks to those efforts, the U.S.'s so-called maximum pressure campaign against Iran has hit the wall, and that's what American officials have also admitted. Addressing the government officials present in the meeting, Ayatollah Khamenei put major emphasis on the need to avoid tying the economy to the outcome of the ongoing Vienna talks aimed at reviving the 2015 Iran deal. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution believes the ultimate solution to the country's economic problems is to rely on the young minds. As he said, they have proved competent in all areas, from the production of COVID vaccines to precision-guided missiles. It's the second time in almost 2 years that Iran's leader has met with Iranian producers. Ayatollah Khamenei has on different occasions highlighted the need to boost domestic production as the key to resistance economy. To this end, he has taken symbolic and practical measures, including naming the current Persian year the year of production, support, and the elimination of obstacles, calling on authorities to materialize this slogan. Boosting domestic production has been one of the main concerns and priorities of Iran's leader. Today, he once again urged the Iranian government to not wait for the removal of U.S. sanctions to fix the economy, and instead capitalize on local producers, as he believes this is the only way toward a resilient economy that can withstand foreign pressures. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Syrian military says its air defenses have intercepted a barrage of Israeli missiles fired at areas around the capital, Damascus. Syrian media quoted a military source as saying that the interception resulted in some material damage. The source added the missiles were fired using the Lebanese airspace. No word from Israel on the latest aerial raid. Israel has ramped up attacks on Syrian soil in recent months. The regime frequently launches missile attacks inside Syria, despite the country's repeated calls for action from the United Nations. The attacks mainly target the Syrian military and resistance fighters battling foreign backed terrorists. Well, we caught up with a journalist and activist, John Bosnich, a short time ago, and asked him how Israel manages to continually get away with such blatant acts of aggression. Let's hear his response.
Well, we've got to start with the fact that we know that there's a high level of military integration between the United States and Israel. And we know now that there's another crisis ongoing in Ukraine, where the United States staged an illegal coup to overthrow the elected legal government of the country. And Israel has a tendency to work in lockstep with the United States. Whenever there's a diversion somewhere else that can draw the media attention away from any crime that might be committed by Israel, that's an opportunity for Israel to take an action. So behind the cover of the United States, behind the diversion of the activity in Ukraine, Israel can take actions which have a twofold purpose: to continue to attempt to destabilize the independent country of Syria, and to go through their regular war routine of testing their systems and seeing what they can do against countries around them.
Now, reports are emerging of Lebanese intelligence services dismantling over a dozen Israeli espionage networks in the past month. According to local media, the networks operated independently of each other in both Lebanon and Syria. A number of arrests have been made. Some detainees have been using drones to collect intelligence. The Israeli spy networks reportedly collected information about Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah and infiltrated into security services. This is the largest security operation performed since 2009, when networks belonging to the Israeli intelligence service Mossad were dismantled. Moscow is threatening to respond if Britain moves to sanction Russian companies close to President Vladimir Putin. The Kremlin expressed alarm, warning that any attack on those firms could backfire on British shareholders and Russian companies. Britain says that it will tighten its sanctions on businesses and people linked to Putin if Russia invades Ukraine. The U.S. and its NATO allies accused Russia of amassing troops near the border to attack Ukraine. Moscow rejects the allegation. It says the move is in response to NATO's deployments to Eastern Europe and Ukraine. Russia has demanded written guarantees against NATO's eastward expansion and the signing up of Ukraine as a member. The Boris Johnson facing a make-or-break week in his premiership as he's bracing for the publication of a government report into lockdown busting parties at Downing Street. The Treasury's chief secretary says the findings of the Sue Gray report will be released soon. The inquiry will look into a string of revelations of gatherings held on government premises in violation of COVID lockdown rules. The allegations have prompted the worst crisis of Johnson's tenure. Also facing several other scandals, the Prime Minister and his Conservative Party have seen their ratings plummet. He's facing calls from across the political spectrum, including his own party, to quit. Johnson has not been consistent in his response to revelations. He's gone from denying that such parties ever existed to denying knowledge of them to recently saying that he believed them to be work events. The death of a famous and elderly photographer on the cold streets of Paris after being ignored for 9 hours has caused shock worldwide. The scandal is forcing France to re-examine how it treats its homeless people. Fabio Lazzari has this story.
What often passes for cultured Parisian cool has been exposed as deadly indifference to suffering humanity following the death of René Robert, a famous photographer of flamenco music. The 85-year-old fainted while on a walk in one of the most crowded areas of Paris. He couldn't get up and then tragically died of hypothermia after being ignored for 9 hours. The death has shocked France and has shamed the capital city in news worldwide. Robert died likely because people assumed he was just another street person in a fabulously rich city where homelessness is somehow a common sight. The person who finally checked on Robert was a homeless person who probably knew all too well the indifference of Paris to people sleeping rough, even in winter.
We keep repeating the same things. Everyone needs access to a life with dignity. We ask for structural reforms which will have real impact on the lives of people living in precarious existence. There has been a disengagement from France regarding the basic social minimums required in life.
Officially, around 6,000 people die on the streets of France each year. But NGOs say the real number is closer to 3,000 people. Refugees, mostly from countries hit by Western military intervention, die out of sight and without identification in tents, pushed into unseen and unlivable corners of the country.
We consider the question of housing to be a vital effort we need to make. We're asking for the basic recognition that everyone needs a roof over their heads. We're asking all the candidates in this spring's election to recognize that a state must take care of people.
Annual budget cuts during the age of austerity have pushed even more poor and mentally ill people into the streets, with evictions exploding so much the government refuses to publish the data anymore. Paris is the most population-dense city in the Western world, but government housing policy favors landlords and not renters. None of these government policy choices really explains the passing of René Robert, but many hope his needless death can change France's indifference towards the plight of those living on the streets. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
The South Korea confirms the launch of an intermediate-range ballistic missile believed to be the most powerful since 2017. The state news agency says the missile was test-fired in a way to ensure the safety of neighboring countries. The United States has dismissed the test as part of Pyongyang's increasingly destabilizing program. It urges North Korea to join direct talks on its nuclear missile programs, saying that Washington would have no preconditions for such meetings. The launch was first reported by South Korean and Japanese authorities on Sunday. Analysts and officials say it's the first time a missile of such dimensions has been launched since the Pyongyang self-imposed moratorium on tests of nuclear weapons in 2017. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Enemy
enmity of arrogant powers towards Iran originates from Leather's anti-arrogance and colonialist spirit. This is the part of a televised speech delivered on January 9, 2022, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on the anniversary of an uprising by the people of Qom on January 9, 1978.
Fortunately, today, the thoughts and ideas of the pious, dedicated youth are wide-ranging. Fortunately, today we are witness to revolutionary, religious, blossoming, progressive ideas presented by a large number of the youth. On this basis, I wish to raise a number of points. There are many points to be raised, but one cannot speak at length about these points in these meetings, so I will only mention several of them. The first point is that, my dear ones, who hear these sentiments from this humble person, you should preserve religious zeal. You must preserve it. The factor that has saved the country in different times has been the religious zeal of the Iranian nation. It is religious zeal that turns threats into opportunities. An example of this was the imposed war, the 8-year sacred defense, which presented a great threat. But the religious zeal of the people, the religious zeal of the youth, the religious zeal of the fathers and mothers and wives caused our youth to go to the front lines. In that war that was truly global, and in which the US, the Soviet Union, NATO, and the reactionary forces in the region those days had all joined hands to defeat Iran, bring Imam to his knees, and annihilate the movement, it was religious zeal that defeated all of them. This achievement had its base in religious zeal. This was about the role of religious zeal during the sacred defense, but there were other events in subsequent years as well.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In our own time, we can mention the martyrdom of our dear martyr, Martyr Soleimani. The martyrdom of Shahid Soleimani truly turned into a historic, astonishing event. No one thought that tragedy would achieve such greatness, and that God, the Exalted, would bless it in such a manner that it would be able to show the religious and revolutionary identity of the people to everyone in the world. The Iranian nation showed its identity and unity in the true sense of the word when they were carrying the coffin of Shahid Soleimani. Well, funerals were held for him in Tehran, in Kerman, in Tabriz, Mashhad, and various other cities in Iran. An enormous funeral was held for him in Iraq too. If that martyr's holy body had been taken to Syria and Lebanon, the same things would have happened there as well.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been guiding me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Hello everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent. On this program, we will address the most important issues in the South Asian region, which affect the governments, organizations, and especially the people. And as always, we will dissect the issues and present you with different perspectives from experts and people. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the conspiracy theory of love jihad propounded by right-wing Hindu groups against Muslims in India, and how the ban on hijab in Indian schools constitutes a blatant breach of religious freedom. And we shall also take a look at desperate attempts made by the government in Indian-controlled Kashmir to stifle free media and intimidate independent journalists.
The toxic wave of Hindu majoritarianism in India is enabling the world's largest democracy to dangerously slide into anarchy. The invoking of the word jihad by Hindu supremacists to accuse Muslims of spreading COVID-19, of buying Hindu land, and most importantly, of marrying Hindu women has assumed alarming proportions. Love jihad, as it's called, is a vicious conspiracy theory with historical roots that radical Hindu groups in India used to vilify, harass, attack, and even kill Muslims.
The obnoxious conspiracy theory of Islamic expansionism in Hindu-majority India has its roots in the country's pre-independence history. Right-wing Hindu groups have always sought to fuel any imaginary fear that Hindu women face a threat from Muslim men. In today's times, it has come to be defined as love jihad, a viral social media expression used extensively by the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party leaders and activists to stoke communal tensions and polarize voters. At least four Indian states ruled by the BJP, including the country's most populous state, Uttar Pradesh, have passed laws criminalizing the so-called love jihad. This theory claims that Muslim men woo Hindu women into wedlock in order to convert them to Islam. The claim is not backed by evidence as corroborated by India's top federal investigative agency and many court rulings. Most recently, in an incident reported from southwestern Karnataka state in September last year, a Muslim man was cruelly killed over an alleged interfaith relationship. The dismembered body of 24-year-old Arbaaz Aftab Mullah was discovered on a stretch of railroad tracks, becoming the latest victim of the so-called love jihad conspiracy theory. The ruling Hindu Nationalist Party in India has been accused of extending overt and covert support to the radical groups targeting Muslim men in the name of love jihad. Prime Minister Narendra Modi's silence, activists say, amounts to either cowardice or complicity.
More than seven decades after independent India's constitution laid the foundation of a secular republic, the country finds itself at crossroads again. The level of religious bigotry in present-day India can be gauged by the fact that for nearly a month, a government college in southwest India has banned Muslim students from attending classes for wearing hijab. The issue has sparked widespread outcry in India and abroad. School authorities say the ban was enforced to maintain uniformity, but Muslim groups denounce it as a blatant violation of their religious freedom.
On a chilly December morning, seven Muslim students were barred from entering their classroom in southwest India's Karnataka state. Their crime was wearing hijab or the Muslim headscarf. Since December the 31st, the girls have been marked absent from their classes, despite them being present in the college every day. While authorities at the Udupi College, apparently under the pressure of the Bharatiya Janata Party government in the state, have been using pressure tactics to coerce them to cave in, the students have maintained a defiant stance. They say that hijab is a part of their identity and faith, and wearing it is a right guaranteed by the Constitution. As a mark of protest, the students have for the past 4 weeks been sitting on the stairs outside their class, photos of which have gone viral on social media. The protesting students have faced humiliation from school authorities and fellow students, as well as from Hindu radicals for their defiance, but they have refused to give up. The incident has drawn anger and outrage across the country, with Muslim groups accusing the college authorities of prejudice against the minority community. At the same time, radical Hindu politicians have told parents that the ban will remain in place.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mrs. Maitrey Krishnan at the All India Lawyers Association for Justice from Bangalore. First of all, welcome to the program, Mrs. Krishnan. Now, Love Jihad has been described as a vicious conspiracy theory that right-wing Hindu groups in India use to harass and attack Muslims. What's its origin and why has it grabbed headlines in recent years?
Hello, everybody, and thanks, Amin, for having me. When we look at what has been happening insofar as what they call Love Jihad is concerned, this is an attempt to demonize the Muslim community. It is an attempt to stop any form of... actually, it is what they're against is love itself. And that's what we have been seeing over the last few years. By bringing about this whole language of Love Jihad, one of the main things that they're trying to do is demonize the Muslim community. The other thing that they're doing is to control the freedom of choice, the sexuality of women. And this is something that they've been doing. This is something that they've been speaking of for the last few years, and over a couple of years or so, it's been something that's been talked about a lot more. And one of the things to note is that in Karnataka, there was in fact an investigation that was ordered into it. And the CID in fact found that there's no such thing, and people who are married outside their religion are quite happy. There was an investigation that was done in Kerala, similarly found the same thing. And if you look at the cases that they speak of as so-called love jihad, and this is in fact a term that we shouldn't just also stop using, but if you look at these, if you look at this, what we will see is that these are basically interreligious, interfaith love situation. It's basically couples who married interfaith, which they're giving this name. And this is something that is... And this is a concerted effort to really bring about, to attack this form of, interreligious, interfaith relationships that are taking place. At the same time, demonize the Muslim community, and it's part of their whole communal agenda to make villains out of Muslims, which is something that we have been seeing.
Mrs. Krishnan, do you think this so-called love jihad, which has become a viral social media expression, is the creation of the Hindu nationalist BJP government to stoke communal tensions and consolidate its Hindu vote bank?
It is definitely something that has it's a concerted kind of effort that is being made by the BJP government. It is part of the Hindutva agenda. One of the biggest challenges that the BJP government faces is situations where there is fraternity, where there is love, or there are relationships between people belonging to different religions, and this is something that is like it's almost like a challenge to them because it's something that they're so against. It is something that there's so over the last few years they have been using this language to really attack people who are. In these relationships, in any form of interfaith or interreligious relationship. I mean, it's also it's something to note that controlling of female sexuality is something that has also been used to maintain the caste system itself, and that's something that has been noted. And it is through this control that the caste system itself has been maintained. And this is now something that is being used to again villainize Muslims, to stoke communal hatred, and to really control women. And this is definitely something this kind of attack against the most basic right to choose, the most basic right to love, is something that they are doing very, very consciously and in an attempt to stoke communal hatred.
Mr. Krishnan, as you know, a 24-year-old Muslim man in the state of Karnataka recently became the latest victim of this conspiracy theory fueled by the unfounded fear of Islamic expansionism. Now, does this point to India's slide into anarchy?
I think the person you're referring to is a young Muslim man, Arbas, who was killed after his hands were tied, his body was mutilated, and he was beheaded for having having had a relationship with a Hindu girl. And for that, he was mutilated, beheaded in this manner. And it is something that was that is extremely concerning. And of course, it points towards the points to what is happening in the country at large. But this is something that we have been saying. In 2015, we had Mr. Aklak, who was lynched because he was allegedly he had eaten beef. This happened in Uttar Pradesh. And today we are seeing a rise in these kind of hate crimes from attacks to murders. That is something that is taking place, and this is certainly something that is extremely concerning.
There you have it, Mrs. Krishnan at the All India Lawyers Association for Justice. Thank you for being on the program, Mrs. Krishnan. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Ahmer Khan, an award-winning Indian multimedia journalist, says the rise of Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party, BJP, in India has seen interfaith marriages becoming a dangerous political flashpoint. New Delhi-based lawyer Kawalpir Kaur hails the Muslim students who are not allowed to enter their classroom in southwestern Karnataka state for wearing hijab as fighters. Nita Parveen, a Kerala-based student activist, slams the decision to ban hijab-wearing Muslim students, says it happens when violence against Muslims is normalized and Islamophobia becomes law.
Listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Classic case of silencing the messenger and muzzling the voice of free media, a group of pro-government journalists in Indian-controlled Kashmir on January 15th seized the region's only independent press club with the assistance of armed policemen. The state-sponsored takeover of the Kashmir Press Club in broad daylight was denounced by leading journalist bodies and political parties in Kashmir. Stung by a massive outcry, the government later declared the press club defunct, much to the chagrin of journalists.
On January the 15th, as the New Delhi-backed administration in Kashmir had announced the weekend lockdown over the surge in COVID-19 cases, a group of government-backed journalists appeared at the Kashmir Press Club in the region's summer capital, Srinagar. What was widely described as forcible and illegal takeover of the independent media body with 300 journalists as members was a move choreographed by the government, which evoked widespread condemnation. The region's former chief minister, Omar Abdullah, called it a state-sponsored coup. The Editors Guild of India said it was aghast at the manner in which the office and the management of Kashmir Press Club was forcibly taken over, and accused the state of being brazenly complicit in this coup. Days after the takeover, the government declared that the only media club in Kashmir had ceased to exist. The largest body of independent journalists in Indian-controlled Kashmir, the club was founded amid much fanfare in 2018. Following the abrogation of Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in 2019, the club was asked to register again as a society. The process encountered multiple hurdles, eventually ending in its overthrow. As one senior club official noted, the only platform that raised the voice against frequent harassment of journalists in Kashmir has now been shut, deregistered, and dispossessed.
The state-backed takeover and the subsequent overthrow of the Kashmir Press Club followed a string of incidents in which local Kashmiri journalists were threatened, harassed, and detained by state agencies on unsubstantiated charges. In a latest case on January 16th, a young Kashmiri journalist, Sajjad Gul, was booked under a draconian law for sharing a video of a Kashmiri family chanting anti-India slogans after their kin was killed by Indian forces. He is not the only one, and certainly not the last.
Since the Hindu nationalist BJP government in New Delhi revoked Indian-controlled Kashmir's special status in August 2019, the crackdown on local Kashmiri journalists and independent media groups has intensified. Journalists who have dared to report critically about New Delhi's controversial measures, including the attempts to change the Muslim-majority region's demography, have faced harassment, intimidation, and even imprisonment. Independent journalists in Kashmir continue to walk the tightrope. Dozens of journalists have been subjected to police raids or interrogation or being put on no-fly lists. Some continue to languish behind bars, and many others face serious criminal charges. The crackdown intensified after the government in June 2020 launched a new media policy that authorized the administration to prosecute those spreading fake news. This law has been used as a pretext to muzzle the voice of independent media in the disputed Himalayan region, believe experts. Sajjad Gul's case is a perfect example of how a draconian law like the Public Safety Act has been abused to target journalists for doing their work. The Editors Guild of India says the space for media freedom and civil society is fading in the region. It lists several cases of detention of journalists, including that of Sajjad Gul, Kamran Yusuf, Pirzada Ashiq, Masrat Zahra, Fahad Shah, the killing of senior journalist Shujaat Bukhari.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. Sanjay Kapoor, the General Secretary of Editors Guild of India. Now, Mr. Kapoor, welcome to the program. What does the takeover and the subsequent overthrow of Kashmir's largest body of independent journalists mean for journalism in the region, and do you see it as an attempt to silence the messenger?
Thank you so much for inviting me to speak on your channel. This is rather distressing what has really happened in Srinagar. Although Srinagar never surprises you, Kashmir never surprises you, because the kind of horror story that keep on emanating from there, not from the last 7 years, but much longer, ever since, you know, the democracy was stifled and the rule of the gun started dictating terms in that valley. It has been like this. You have journalists who are, being pressured and pushed from two sides, one from the side of the extremists and the other side from the government. So there is not really exactly the freedom of expression or speech that we can really think of. And what has really happened is one more episode of the same saga which has been unfolding for quite a while. So closure of the press club is a phenomenon which we had never heard before. And the fact that it has happened and the authorities have managed to get away with it suggests that such episodes, such happenings can take place anytime, anywhere. There is a point of view which the government authorities have also been presenting for a while. They said that you had all kinds of people who had become members of the press club. They were not journalists, and that allowed a point of view to disseminate from press club, that ideas which are not normally reserved for the media were flowing out of it. They were hinting at the extremists who were using the platform, the press club, to pretty much spread anything they wanted to. But that's not true, because the manner in which the government has intervened, they could have avoided that situation. They could have allowed the two factions within the press club to manage their own affairs. They could have done things in a manner which should have ensured that the government hand is not visible. In this case, the high-handedness of the authorities is so much there that they have not only taken control of the club, they have even taken control of the property. And yesterday or day before, I was seeing the social media that the big hoarding which was put on top of the press club, suggesting it was a Srinagar press club, that was also withdrawn. So they don't want to have any evidence of the fact that this building used to hold the press club, which not only just provide people to come and converse with each other, but also provided a place where journalists could come and work, because Srinagar has been very difficult of late with the where reporting is concerned. Internet shutdown is a very routine thing, so journalists would come here and find ways to somehow send out the reports but now this club has gone away. I think one of the places where they used to get support, that has also gone away.
Mr. Kapoor, many national level media bodies and political parties denounced the move they claimed was backed by the state. So why is the government so afraid of free media in Kashmir?
Government is afraid of free media, not from now, but as I said, there is a past, there's a history to it. It's in a conflict area where you have Pakistan on the other side laying claims on the land for quite a while. This is a legacy of 1947 partition. They think that because it's a majority area of minorities of the Muslims, they are the rightful owner of the land. And there are always competing views that you hear. You have the Indian government and the nationalists who continue to suggest that the point of view which is peddled more or which is accepted more by the Muslims of the valley comes from Pakistan. So in a certain way, the government disputes any point of view coming in from independent media because they think it is flowing in from the neighboring country. So that is why, as I said earlier, the journalists are torn between the two. I mean, there is a feeling that the Indian government is working at cross purposes. They are not really interested in ensuring a democracy in the place because they fear that will be hijacked by elements and people who are not in favor of the state. So time and again, you have the assemblies which have been, they have been thrown out by the center. That was many, many years ago. Subsequent to that, you had elections which did not get any kind of participation. And now you have a situation where the government of India has done away with the state as such. I mean, the Jammu and Kashmir used to be a combined state, but after August 5th, 2019, the very nature of the state has changed. Although the Home Minister Amit Shah is saying that he will restore the state, but nothing like that is happening. So in a certain way, freedom of free media is something that the government is not even very clear what it would be, because anybody who disputes the narrative is the one that they would distrust most. And at the moment, the government narrative is not acceptable till the time it is forced out.
Mr. Kapoor, as you know, the takeover of the Kashmir Press Club followed many incidents in which local journalists were harassed and detained by government forces. Now, are these strong-arm tactics aimed at controlling the media?
I mean, let's face it, in Kashmir, it's a police state. And democracy deficit has been taking place in practically most of society. Very, very little space for free media in many societies which used to swear by democracy, and worse so when you have a conflict situation. So journalists have been picked up. There's so many who have been picked up just for tweeting. The tweet, if you do, has become the enemy of the state as such. If you say something that goes contrary to the point of view represented by the government, then you are being anti-national, and that is the fear that many of us actually experience even in day-to-day life, because you don't know what is the band of the narrative that we can play with. And this has happened in Kashmir more so because that's an area where the government is very, very keen that nothing should get out which goes contrary to the message that they want, and that is where a lot of these journalists end up being on the wrong side of law.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Kapoor, the General Secretary of Editors Guild of India, for his precious time and insight. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media.
Senior Kashmiri journalist Pirzada Ashraf calls it sad and painful to see Kashmir's only independent press club being sealed, says it functioned even at the peak of political unrest and the COVID-19 pandemic. Salman Nizami, a Congress party leader, says the armed takeover of Kashmir Press Club undermines institutions and reduces press freedom to a joke in the conflict-marred region. Pro-freedom Kashmiri leader Masroor Ansari cites a news report to assert that journalists in Kashmir have contended with various threats, but their situation has gotten dramatically worse since 2019.
And that was our episode about the rising tide of Islamophobia in BJP-ruled India, and also the attempts to throttle the freedom of press in Indian-controlled Kashmir. Thank you for your time, everyone. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take good care.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خدا ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
One reporter asks, "The fact that I have been accepted as a woman shows that our movement is a progressive one, even though some have tried to portray it as retrograde. Do you think women must necessarily wear Islamic dress or hijab? Must they cover their hair or not?" Imam replies, "To say I have accepted you means nothing. I have not personally accepted you. You came here without my knowledge. This is not proof that Islam is progressive. Islam did not become progressive the minute you walked here. Progress is not what some of our women or our men think it is. Progress is determined in terms of human and spiritual perfections and by how useful a person is for the nation and the country, not by whether people go to the cinema or dances. These are things. They made you think were progressive so they could drive you into a backward state. Later we must remedy this. In salutary activities, we are free. We are free to go to university and to do any kind of respectable job. The whole nation is free in this regard. However, if anyone wants to do something immodest or harmful to the nation, he or she will be prevented. This is a sign of being progressive." January 23rd, 1979.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to the program Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsin Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the search of Islam. Imam Khomeini has said that we rose up for Islam just as the noble prophet did at the advent of Islam, but we did not suffer and toiled as much as he. In this part of speech, Imam Khomeini is saying the cause of raising and having the revolution, it's to follow the footsteps of the noble prophet as he did at the advent of Islam. He did it for the justice, for the cause of Islam. But the second part which he is mentioning is that we did not suffer and toil as much as he, means the prophet, did. In the narrations, we have this narration that the prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam had more pain, and none of the prophets, obviously we had 124,000 prophets and messengers, none of the prophets had this much of pain, did this much or this amount of pain which the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam had.
Ya Rabbana, salli ala Taha al-Nabi wa alihi sallallahu
preached Islam for 23 years, and on the other hand, we can see that the Prophet Noah has preached among his people before the storm 950 years, and even after the storm, there were like he was alive and the preaching continued. He even did not face that much of pain. Or at the time of the Prophet Moses, or Prophet Abraham, or Prophet Jesus, all these prophets that we see, they did not suffer such a pain which the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam has this pain in his life. And the cause of being patient on all these pains which he was suffered, he went through, it was all because of Islam. Islam is not just mere a religion the way we can see in the rest of the world. People have just a belief and following it. No, Islam is the set of life. Islam is the way of freedom. Inshallah, we will try to strive for Islam as well.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Islamic and national forces in the Gaza Strip held a rally near the separation fence between Gaza and the occupied lands. The rally comes to voice the Palestinian outrage of the Israeli apartheid policies of land grabbing. And Naqab is witnessing a wave of forced displacement by Israel's system of apartheid against all Palestinians. Considering these Israeli attempts to expel thousands of Palestinians from their homes and lands a crime against humanity, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip expressed their support to Palestinians in Al-Naqab, south of the country.
The Israeli regime has stolen our land since 1948. Until this moment, it keeps practicing apartheid attempts to take our lands by force. My work...